Save big this summer with great deals. All in the Kroger app.
Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor Super Drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined by JC Abbott. And today we're discussing Hamilton's decision to squib kick in the final minute of their game against Ottawa.
The Toronto Argonauts honoring some franchise legends.
The Edmonton Elks giving up a first-round pick in next year's draft.
The league's three winless teams.
And make our picks for week 5 in the CFL. But first, JC, the Saskatchewan Roughriders have placed Trevor Harris on the 6-game injured list with what they've identified as a moderate MCL sprain. The veteran passer suffered the injury against the Hamilton Tiger Cats in week 3 and he wanted to return for the second half, though head coach Corey Mace wasn't willing to risk further injury. Shea Patterson will make his first career CFL start against the visiting Toronto Argonauts on Thursday. JC, how do you expect Patterson to look at the helm in Ryderville?
Well, I don't think it's a secret that I've been one of the biggest Shea Patterson skeptics out there in the media landscape, particularly when he was involved in that training camp battle with Mason Fine for the backup job. And for all of you people in Ryderville who are banging the table saying, we got to go with Shea Patterson. He's going to be the guy. He could be the next one. Well, you got what you wished for. We're going to get a long look at whether Shea Patterson can be a starting quarterback in the CFL after he floundered out of the USFL and after he failed to win jobs with multiple other CFL clubs. Now you're getting your wish. He is going to have to steer you for 4 to 6 weeks, potentially even longer, as Harris deals with this moderate MCL sprain. And frankly, it's a tough situation to come in off the bench like he did in week 3, but that was not a good enough performance. If Shea Patterson looks anything like he did in that first outing off the bench, the Saskatchewan Roughriders have no shot of getting a victory during that stretch of time. He only threw for 41 yards passing. I thought he was off target on a number of throws, put the ball in jeopardy as well. Luckily, they already had a lead and they were having a strong defensive and special teams outing on that particular day. But Shea Patterson needs to show that he can manage that offense, that he can protect the football, and that he can put up a reasonable amount of yardage if he's going to steer this team through this difficult patch.
Yeah, the second half of last week's game was a major red flag for me because the Hamilton Tiger Cats have struggled on the defensive side of the ball for much of the season. I also think that coming in relief is a bit of an advantage for the quarterback, right? Especially in a place like Saskatchewan where Trevor Harris is very much, you know, not immobile entirely, but somebody who is not going to rely on his legs to make a ton of plays. Somebody who is more of your prototypical drop back to pass pocket passer versus a guy like Shea Patterson, who is more of a dual threat player, or certainly somebody who's a lot younger, right? He's a decade younger than Trevor Harris, certainly has younger, fresher legs, more ability to do some read option type things, right? A little bit more creativity from the back of that offense. You mentioned the USFL, which I think is interesting to talk about. Shea Patterson, for the uninitiated, was the first overall pick in the 2022 USFL draft to the Michigan Panthers. He was then cut by the team before that season got underway. Ended up getting picked up later on that season with New Orleans, and all in all, did not play well. Threw 4 touchdowns, 5 interceptions in the USFL. Never a good sign when you're cut as the first overall pick. Mind you, the Panthers were a struggling team, and he did play some of the season with them, but regardless, the point is this is somebody who struggled.
Out to Paxton Lynch, for all you Rider fans out there who remember that tall drink of water.
Yeah, I don't remember who he lost the job to. All I know is that he hardly grabbed it by the reins. Right, he struggled, and at the end of the day, when you look at the quarterbacks who have played in the USFL, like for example, that same draft, the third overall pick was Brian Scott, who is now the backup in Toronto. So there's no one from that list who like explodes out at you. It's like, whoa, this guy was in that draft. So the point is, I'm a little bit skeptical about Shea Patterson going into this game. However, with that being said, I'm thrilled he's getting his opportunity. Like this is somebody who put up good numbers at Ole Miss, put up good numbers at the University of Michigan, and all due respect to a lot of small school guys who have had a lot of success as quarterbacks in the CFL. Most recently, Cameron Dukes, a guy who played at a relatively low level, very small college, right, has obviously had quick success. Patterson played at two of the largest programs in the history of American college football. Does that mean he's going to be a great CFL quarterback? Of course not. However, I do think it means he deserves his opportunity, and this is his first opportunity to start a CFL game. I'm glad he's getting it after previously having stints at BC, having stints in Montreal. It's easy to forget now, but Cody Fajardo, for instance, was once a big school guy out of the University of Nevada who did nothing in Toronto.
Nevada's not a big school, Hodge. Come on.
Big-ish
school. No, they play in the Mountain West. What are you talking about?
Nevada is a lot closer to Michigan than it is to this Lindsey Wilson College.
Yeah,
where
but Lindsey Wilson
Cameron
College
Dukes came
is,
from.
Is closer to my high school than it is to Michigan. Like, I mean,
what I'm saying is, on the spectrum of schools from which CFL quarterbacks came, Nevada is probably on the bigger side than the smaller side. Though I concede that you know more about college football than I do. At the end of the day, Nevada is a major program that has produced major professional level talent, most notably Colin Kaepernick, who was a very good quarterback with the San Francisco 49ers for a few years. Regardless, Fajardo did nothing during his stints with Toronto and BC and then became sensational with the Saskatchewan Roughriders, hit the bricks for a while. And is now, right now, again, I said this on last week's show, I'll say it again, after another strong performance, to me, if I were to cast my ballot today, my MOP this season would be Cody Fajardo. So I'm glad that Shea Patterson is getting this opportunity, and what he does with it will be up to him.
I think there was a number of ridiculous takes in that particular rant, Hodge. Notably, Nevada is a small school. If you go back, like by NFL standards, they consider Nevada, because it's group of five, to be a small school. But also, you're voting for Cody Fajardo over Vernon Adams Jr. right now for MOP?
I would not
get behind that at all.
I mean, I'd have to dig more into those two. I would assume that right now those would be the two candidates at the very least. I would be tempted to vote for Cody because I think that he, from a supporting cast standpoint, I think Vernon Adams Jr. has a little bit of a stronger supporting cast, and I think that the Alouettes have been the better team overall, which when you're looking for a tiebreaker, maybe that's it. It certainly seemed to be the case last year when people were voting for Chad Kelly, simply because the Argos were really good, even though his season was not as strong as Brady Oliveira's, objectively. But regardless, the point is, from when you look at the landscape of CFL quarterbacks, a league where guys have come out of D2, guys have come out of the NAIA, guys have come out of the junior college ranks, Nevada is at least a middling program. Michigan is certainly a top-level program. The point is, Shea Patterson played at two elite colleges. That doesn't mean he's going to be a successful CFL quarterback, but it certainly means, in my opinion, he deserves the chance to compete.
I mean, let's think back. When was the last time we had a really, truly successful, well, I guess Chad Kelly counts, coming out of Ole Miss, out of an SEC program for a year before all the stuff that's happened with him. But there's not a great track record of truly big, big school quarterbacks having success in the CFL dating back decades, right? And typically it has been guys from smaller FBS programs or FCS programs who have found the most success here. I think sometimes when you go to a school like Michigan and you're Shea Patterson, there's less put on you. Yeah, you've got the pressure of that 100,000 seat stadium and all of that, but you've also got a bunch of five-star recruits that you get to throw to, and your running back's a five-star, and your offensive line is all top recruits, and so you have, to your point, a better supporting cast around
you're
you.
You're also playing against five-star corners and five-star pass rushers. That's the counter argument as well. You're playing elite competition when you're at Michigan. Yes, you're playing with elite players as well. I would say in terms of the transition from college to the CFL, the reason you don't see a lot of guys from the top programs come to the CFL and have success is because the NFL is never going to miss, right, on a player who played at a top program. And, mind you, that's not true. They missed on Cameron Wake, who played at Penn State. But at the quarterback position, they're not going to miss out on guys who are playing at elite level, top level programs. They might. Right, miss on the guys who are in the group of five, who are playing lower levels of college football, what have you. Again, how will he look? We don't know. We know that Sean Bain Jr. is not going to play in this game. Keyshawn Johnson, former NFL receiver, and no, not that Keyshawn Johnson, the other Keyshawn Johnson, will be playing in that boundary wideout spot. So it'll be interesting to see that the Argos have reconfigured their secondary for this game. We'll talk more about that when we make our picks a little bit later on. But regardless, I'm interested to see what Shea Patterson is going to do. And I'm happy he gets the shot. And I'm happy, by the way, for the CFL, right? You talked about this during the preseason. The retreads, the Mason Fines, who've already gotten their opportunities, right? Why not hand it to a new person, right? Have new blood in this league. Mm. Shea Patterson might be the worst quarterback you've ever seen in your life, but at least he's getting that shot to be that new guy, right? That fresh blood. And I do think that this league needs fresh blood at the quarterback position, especially when you look at the age of guys like Trevor Harris, guys like Zach Collaros, guys like McLeod Bethel-Thompson, right? There are a lot of old heads currently starting at the quarterback position in this league, and we always want the next generation to be ready and to step up.
Yeah, for the sake of the people in the province of Saskatchewan and for the Saskatchewan Roughriders, I hope I'm wrong. I'm skeptical of Shea Patterson. Hopefully he can get it done on the field. If not, maybe in a couple weeks we see some Jack Cohen. That's a real big school, Notre Dame.
And I'm Notre Dame is a big school. Though I don't think you're skeptical, JC. I think I'm skeptical. I think you're a hater.
I am a well-documented, back to Michigan, Shea Patterson hater.
Or a shader, if you will.
A
shader? A shader.
Careful. We're one letter off something else there.
We're getting a little bit close to some not safe for work language. But I said it clearly. A shader. A Shay hater.
Okay. Let's go. Hodge, 3-0 Nation Award against Worst Play of the Week to the Hamilton Tiger Cats for squibbing a kickoff in the final minute of their game against the Ottawa Redblacks when they were up by just a single point. With the honorable mention going to Chris Strevler of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers for his overtime interception. In your opinion, which play was worse?
I think it would have been the Strevler interception. However, he told 680 CJOB post-game that he was hit as he threw. He really wasn't able to step into the throw fully. He was facing an all-out blitz. Kudos to him for getting the ball out. Just had to do it a tiny bit sooner. So to me, the play's still bad because, of course, you have to beat the blitz. You got to get the ball out. But it was made less so by the knowledge that he was hit. And it is clear on replay that his arm was impacted on the throw, which is why it was so underthrown and why it fell, of course, into harm's way with Demario Houston intercepting it. I believe it was a post route from, or at least intended for Nick Dembski from Chris Strevler. So to me, that's why the squib is the worst play. Obviously, Devontae Dedman had the best of the Hamilton Tiger Cats in this game. They actually kicked away from him on this play to get Tobias Harris the ball. The issue was the Ticats couldn't tackle him either. Tobias Harris made multiple men miss, got the ball to almost midfield. And we all know in the CFL, I mean, you can actually run a considerable number of plays in the last 20 to 30 seconds of a game. And ultimately, had the Ticats just kicked this ball long, I think we would have seen them win this game. Certainly, or at least they had a better chance of winning this game than squibbing it and putting the Ticats in a better position to, or at least allowing the Ticats to start that return further up the field.
Yeah, there's an easy way to answer this question, but it comes with another question. So I hope you're ready, Hodge. Which of these two plays got somebody fired?
The squib kick got somebody fired. Presumably.
So that's the
presumably
worst one.
We are speculating.
We, of course, don't know all of the context behind that, but the Hamilton Tiger Cats, after that game, have moved on from special teams coordinator Paul Boudreau. And presumably, if it wasn't the entire reason, this decision to squib kick with a minute left in the game, up by 1 point, was at least an influence in why they made that choice to move on from him. It was one of the most baffling coaching decisions that I've ever seen watching the CFL. You have to kick it deep in that situation, no matter who the returner is. I don't care that Devontae Dedmon is one of the most dangerous players in the league or that he was giving you fits all night. If your special teams unit is not good enough to trust them in that situation to pin it deep, oh boy, like there are much deeper problems that have to be addressed, because if you squib, you just gave them the victory in any scenario. Even if the man on first contact had tackled Tobias Harris, you've almost put your opponent in field goal range to win that game in an easy scenario. It was a gift for the Ottawa Redblacks, and it resulted in them getting a walk-off victory that, you know what, they probably didn't deserve in that situation. I've seen some criticism on Boudreau getting thrown under the bus. Like, does Scott Milanovic know what's happening in that situation? I'm not certain he does. I don't know how their operation works on the sideline, but certainly anybody who was responsible for that type of call, whether it's a player ad-libbing on the field, whether it's the coach on the sideline, deserves some blame for this loss.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a decision that the head coach would make, right? We're squibbing it or we're kicking it long. To me, and this is just my opinion, you need to kick it long because at the very least, you'll have a longer play, right? If the returner has to corral the ball at their own 5-yard line, their own 10-yard line, wherever the ball may land, you are taking more time off the clock. And when there are approximately 30 seconds left in a game, killing the clock is your number one priority, right? Versus squibbing it, which will allow the ball to be fielded quicker up the field, right? Which will allow not only less time to run off the clock, but also presumably give the opposing team a better start when it comes to their field position. Now, should be noted, I went and looked at the CFL stats. Hamilton, as of Boudreau's firing, ranked 3rd league-wide in net punting, 4th in punt return average, 8th in opponent punt return average, 6th in kickoff return average, and 7th in opponent kickoff return average. So the kickoff numbers are not great, but the punting numbers are good, right? 3rd league-wide in net punting, 8th in opponent punt return average means that, okay, we're giving up a fair number of yards on these returns. However, that is because we are presumably kicking the ball very long, right? Because they're still 3rd in net punting average, which is, in my opinion, a number that matters far more than just the sheer number of return yards you're giving up. So the Tabbies did not have great special teams units through the first 4 games, but obviously they were also not great. You know, Paul Boudreau was not retained by the Winnipeg Blue Bombers following the 2023 season, but he also helped them win 2 Grey Cups and was there for 6 years working on a staff that included Mike O'Shea, who's probably one of the brightest special teams minds in the history of the Canadian Football League. So I don't think he's a bad coach, but obviously the Ticats felt the need to make a change. My biggest disappointment with this, and I rarely throw our colleagues in the media under the bus, but I watched Scott Milanovic's video press conference after this game, and nobody asked him about the squib kick. And far be it from me to suggest that I'm perfect and I've asked every question that ever needs to be asked at a press conference, but I would please ask of our friends in the media coast to coast, when there is a game-changing, shocking play at the end of a game, can we please ask a question about it? Because I would have loved to know, did you call the squib kick or did that come from the special teams coordinator? And now that the squib kick has happened, what was your reaction? Scott Milanovich might not have answered, right? He is within his right to just say, well, we're not talking about that, or, oh, I got to go watch the film, which is my favorite line, by the way, people give to get out of asking a tough question. But the question needed to be asked, and nobody asked him, which is too bad. And nobody's had the chance to ask him because the Tabbies have not started practicing yet. They don't play until Sunday. So I would have loved to hear the rationale behind this. We didn't get it.
And you know what? Milanovich may have opened up and said something notable because he has in the past, right? This is a guy who in the preseason lambasted his special teams unit for committing too many penalties and said, if things don't change, well, there are going to be consequences. People are going to lose their jobs. At the time, it was implied that it was going to be players getting cut after training camp, but clearly that same mentality applied to the coaching over the first 4 weeks of the season, and that's why the axe falls.
Yes, that is a very good point. And when it comes to, you know, the spectrum of boring to interesting or opaque to transparent, right, the head coaches across the league, I would think that Scott Milanovich is more on the second half of that side, right? He is one of the more interesting coaches when it comes to offering on what appears to be at least honest answers to questions. And he also seems to be quite transparent. And I think probably his extensive experience as a head coach, right, plays into that. He's been a head coach technically in multiple.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app.
Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor super drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Places, though, he, of course, never coached a game with the Edmonton Elks in 2020. He's a guy who
they've had in a while.
Well, I mean, he won zero games, but I get what you're saying.
100% of his games were won.
No, 0% of his games were won because it was zero, but you could say 0% of the games were lost. It's both. Yeah. So you say it's 0% was lost. Regardless. Yeah. This was a baffling decision. And it let, left much to be desired, and Tabby's fans are obviously unhappy. An 0-4 start, I don't think, is what they're anticipating, especially with Bo Levi Mitchell through at least the first 2 weeks of the season looking good. Bo did not look great this past week, but he didn't look terrible. And I agree with you, JC. The Tabbies should have won that game. I thought they were the better team. The Edmonton Elks, speaking of the Edmonton Elks, are on a bye this week, leaving Hamilton and Winnipeg as the only two teams in the CFL currently without any wins. The Tiger Cats will host the BC Lions on Saturday, while the Blue Bombers will host the Ottawa Redblacks on Friday. JC, do you see either club winning this week? And which team do you think will go the longest without winning a game?
I think it's going to be the Hamilton Tiger Cats that go the longest without winning a game, because Winnipeg has Ottawa this week. I know Ottawa beat them in the first matchup, but this time it's at home at Princess Auto Stadium. Even though there's a lot of problems and injury issues with this team, I think Ottawa hasn't blown me out of the water with their performances, and Winnipeg has improved slightly offensively throughout this stretch. I think at some point they're going to click, and it could potentially be this week. And then when Edmonton comes back, they've got Ottawa back-to-back as well. So to me, that leaves the Hamilton Tiger Cats, who have BC and then Toronto and then Edmonton, where one of them will have to win, as the most vulnerable team, in my estimation, to go the longest without a victory. I think all three of these teams have been in winnable games, right? That's the thing that is the most difficult for these fan bases. They're not getting blown out of the water. They've been tight losses. And I think a lot of these, the players and coaches here are justified when they say we could have won any of our four games or any of our three games and we were right there. It's true, but each of them has to find a way to get over the hump.
Yes, and I mean, the team that's actually been the most consistently competitive, I think, is Edmonton, right? They could truly have won any of their four games. Winnipeg got pretty thoroughly whooped week one against Montreal. Since then, the games have all been close. And Hamilton, I think, should certainly have won their first game against Calgary. If Tim White can catch, they win that game. Ditto week two in Sask. Now, they got whipped at Mosaic Stadium in week three, but we just agreed they should have won in week four. So I wouldn't be pressing the panic button if I was any of these teams. That being said, I do think the Hamilton Tiger Cats are the closest to pressing the panic button. I mean, they just fired a coach, obviously. But looking at their schedule, it's tough. They are at home the next 2 weeks, which is good. It's tough to play at Tim Hortons Field. However, they're hosting BC and Toronto. BC is well-rested this week. Toronto, always a tough game. And then they have to go to Edmonton. No, the Elks have not played great at Commonwealth Stadium, but again, they are much improved. And then they've got a back-to-back with the Montreal Alouettes getting to the midway point of the season. I threw the question out on Twitter, what will this team's record be by the midway point of the season? I think they would take 3-6 in a heartbeat right now. Winning three of these five games, I think they would be very happy with that. My suspicion is they will win one or two. And if you are 1-8 or 2-7 at the midway point, that is troubling. Now, Winnipeg and Edmonton, I think, are in better spots. Both of these teams next play Ottawa at home. Ottawa's in Winnipeg this week while Edmonton's on a bye, then travels to Commonwealth. I actually think Winnipeg and Edmonton are going to win both of those games, though it depends on the health of Zach Kolaris. As of the recording of this, we do not have any clarity as to whether or not he'll play. Immediately following last week's loss to Calgary, Mike O'Shea told 680 CJOB that Zach was out just for precautionary reasons and seemed fine. But then Kolaris didn't practice on Tuesday, and Mike O'Shea, as usual, was very cagey about whether or not his quarterback was in fact healthy. So remains to be seen in that regard. But the point is, Edmonton and Winnipeg have much softer schedules over the next five games. Not to say that Ottawa's an easy out necessarily, but Edmonton also has Hamilton, right? They have Saskatchewan. Winnipeg has to go to Saskatchewan, but they've got Calgary at home. So I think that the schedule is just a little bit easier from that perspective. So very interesting. And by the way, with Edmonton and Winnipeg off to 0-4 starts, assuming they can pick things up, that's going to make for some very interesting second half meetings this season when the two teams inevitably go head to head, because neither team is in a position right now where the playoffs aren't possible. But inevitably, with a bad start, once you play each other, you're going to have to take those games to come out ahead of the other team in the standings and possibly make some noise in the West Division playoffs.
We're in the midst of the Elks bye week right now, and I believe you went on the record several weeks ago, Hodge, after Edmonton's first loss, by saying if they go 0-4, this would be the time that a change would be made coaching staff with Chris Jones. It doesn't seem like that's in the cards right now. It's been awfully quiet out of Edmonton. Of course, they could still make a move, but usually you would do that at the start of the break versus in the middle or at the end. Do you think the way that they've lost these games, how tight it's been, has changed the perception or the stability of Chris Jones in Edmonton, or do you still believe he'll be gone?
I mean, he's not going to be gone. He's safe. And I believe the reason is somewhat of what you laid out. Yes, it's true that they have been a very respectable, solid team, despite the fact that they have been completely unable to close out games, sometimes to the point of it almost being comical, right, how badly they have faltered at the end of games. With that being said, I think this has to do much more with Edmonton's ownership situation. The last that I spoke to my sources at Edmonton, they indicated that, like, quite literally, the sooner the better this team gets sold. I know that there was a report out of Edmonton this week that it's a done deal. I know that TSN refuted that, saying that it's not a done deal, but there still should be something done mid-season. Again, the last that I spoke to my sources, they indicated the earlier the better. And so, I mean, presumably, right, to help this ailing club lose the least money possible. And I think that ultimately is a big factor, because if the Elks were to fire Chris Jones now, then it is a community-owned team that is hemorrhaging money, paying him out for that subsequent buyout, versus why not have an owner come in and that be something that they do to foot the bill. So I'm not bullish on Chris Jones's tenure long term at Edmonton, but I do think that the ownership strife that, you know, is impacting that club right now and will hopefully be resolved in about a month's time. I do think that that is giving him some extra job security. And who knows? I mean, if they win their next five, because again, their schedule is not daunting. Ottawa twice, Hamilton at Sask, and then versus BC. If they can win four of those games, maybe he gets the rest of the year. But obviously, I think Edmonton would have to do something pretty extraordinary for Chris Jones to still be the coach and GM come 2025.
Yeah, I think he's a cat with nine lives right now because of the circumstances around him. Like, he should have been gone last year, but they couldn't because of the way that his contract was rewritten so that he had that protection of the guaranteed money under the coach's cap. Now he's here. He probably should be gone after an 0-4 start, but because of that ownership situation, nobody wants to pull the trigger and put that on ownership before that group can make its own decision. That gives him the chance to come back and put together some victories. And quite frankly, as much as I am not a fan of Chris Jones' management of that team over the past 3 years, and I think that it won't truly get over the hump until there is new management there, they have the potential to be a playoff team in a West division that looks a lot weaker at the bottom than it has in recent years. They've been close, and that matters. If he makes the playoffs at the end of the season after being granted this extra time, does that push him into year four? Does a new owner coming in that maybe is just getting a feel for what managing a football team is like, leaning on an experienced coach, see a turnaround? I could see it happening, unfortunately, which personally I don't think would be great for the green and gold, but it's going to be great for Chris Jones one way or the other.
Well, and I've, you know, talking to people around the league, they've kind of said like, well, what's the point in firing Chris Jones when, you know, presumably you're just going to have to promote his right-hand man, essentially, to take over for him. And that's a fair question. This is probably a team that will need a reset under a new owner. But at the same time, I mean, you talked about, you know, the team improving. Like, yes, Calgary's 2-1 right now, but they've got Montreal, Winnipeg, and BC coming up. Obviously, the Winnipeg game could be a win, given the Bombers' very slow start. But, like, this is a team, point is, that could easily be, you know, 2-4, you know, in a few weeks' time. You look at the Saskatchewan Roughriders, yes, they're 3-0. No, I'm not taking anything away from that, but they've also only beaten Edmonton and Hamilton. Like, this team is about to face a lot tougher tests. They've got Toronto this week, BC the next. They've got Montreal in 4 weeks' time. So Edmonton, I don't think, is anywhere close to down and out. In a month's time, we could easily be looking at an Edmonton team that's, you know, 3-5, dare I say even 4-4, and they are right there in the middle of that West Division with Calgary and Saskatchewan. I don't see the BC Lions falling back to the pack. I think the BC Lions have set themselves up very well to finish first in the West Division, as much as it is still early. Their schedule is a bit of a sweetheart schedule for the next little bit. They got Hamilton this week again, Sask, then Calgary, then Winnipeg, then Edmonton. Yes, they obviously have Montreal later on down the road, but they've already played Toronto and had to go to Toronto for that game. So that's one of the toughest games on your schedule that is checked off the board. So if you're Edmonton, if you're Winnipeg, I don't think that you have to hit the panic button yet, because I think there is upward mobility in that West Division. But obviously, the wins have to start coming now. Like, if Winnipeg loses to Ottawa this week, I don't know what you point to and say, oh, look, here's our chance for hope, or here's why we have to keep our process the same. At some point, you got to just win a damn game. It's now time to make our picks for week 5 in the CFL, JC. Let's go. The Toronto Argonauts are 3-point favorites over the Saskatchewan Roughriders at Mosaic Stadium on Thursday night. The Boatmen are coming off a disappointing home loss to the Montreal Alouettes, while Shea Patterson will make his first career CFL start as Trevor Harris is out due to an MCL sprain. JC, can the Argos cover the spread on the road, or will the Riders surprise them with Patterson at the helm?
I know that the Argos struggled a little bit last week against the Montreal Alouettes, who are the top team in the CFL right now, and maybe a little bit of the shine came off of Cameron Dukes in the process. But I can't believe that the spread is this tight when the Argos have been one of the most talented teams in the CFL, and Saskatchewan is fielding a completely unproven quarterback. I've made my thoughts on Shea Patterson known on this podcast. I don't think he's going to be any good at the helm. He certainly needs to have a much better performance than he did when he came off the bench in week three. I don't think he gets it, and I think this Riders team gets overwhelmed by the Argonauts at home. I'm taking Toronto, and I'd take them up to over a touchdown.
Yeah, I think the line is a credit to just how much of a tough place to play Mosaic Stadium is, right? I know attendance was disappointing for the club's home opener, but one would think with the team at 3-0, there's going to be a little bit more fervor in that building. I know it doesn't fill up great on Thursday nights. I would imagine the Saskatchewan Roughriders would have been much happier with a Friday game or a Saturday game, because I know they draw a lot of fans from outside the city limits of Regina who maybe have a difficult time getting to the facility on a Thursday night. But that being said, I am all over the Argonauts in this one still. They are starting to get a little bit healthier. They are still banged up along the defensive line with Falara Nurmulade out. They missed him, I thought, quite badly last week. They also lost Quincy Mojay at strong side linebacker. They've got Robert Priester coming in and starting there. Well, they just signed him a couple of days ago. Yes, he played on the team last year, but having a guy go from the street to the starting lineup is a little bit of a question mark. That being said, I did not see anywhere near enough from Shea Patterson to believe in him enough for this week that he can beat a good team. And the Argonauts are a good team. If I am the Argos, I am stacking that line of scrimmage, completely taking AJ Ouellette away and forcing Shea Patterson to beat me with his arm. I'm not sure he can do it. He has a chance to become a folk hero in Regina if he does. But right now, I got to take the tried and true. I'm going to the Toronto Argonauts over the Saskatchewan Roughriders and covering that field goal spread. The Winnipeg Blue Bombers are 3-point home favorites against the Ottawa Redblacks on Friday night, despite being off to an 0-4 start. Zach Kolaris missed practice on Tuesday while the Redblacks are coming off a walk-off home win against the Hamilton Tiger Cats. JC, can Winnipeg get win number one and cover this short spread?
I keep going back and forth on this matchup because obviously the Redblacks beat them in the first time around. The Bombers have not looked like themselves, and there's all these injury questions. We know about the hit they've taken in the receiving core, but Zach Kolaris not being on the field over the last number of years, if we had heard that, it would have been press the panic button because he was so important to this team. Now, I'm wondering just how important he really is. He has not been good for the first part of the season. And as you've so wonderfully pointed out in your post-game columns, Hodge, he's locked in on specific receivers, has not spread the ball around. Chris Streveler did do that. As much as I am not thrilled with his ability as a passer, he did spread the ball around, and he adds an element with his legs that I think the Redblacks might have some difficulty defending. I think even if Streveler is the guy, the Bombers get their first victory here, although I am not confident enough in that assessment not to take the Redblacks to cover. I know it's a short spread, but I want to hedge my bets here.
That's fair, and I'm going to not hedge my bets here, and then I'll probably regret it next week because I am taking Winnipeg to win and cover here. Princess Auto Stadium is a tough place to play. Yes, I picked the BC Lions when the Lions came to town a couple weeks ago, and yes, the Lions covered a very short spread, but I don't think the Redblacks are on the BC Lions level. And as much as, yes, this Winnipeg team will miss Zach Kolaris if, in fact, he does not play, we don't know that, again, as of the recording of this show, I thought that Chris Streveler brought some much-needed energy and some life into that offense. Last week and a half of work, Zach Collaros only threw 12 passes, and 7 were to Nick Dembski. 2 were to Drew Olatarski, and a couple were dump-offs to running backs and fullbacks. All of a sudden, Chris Trevler comes in the game, and look, Josh Johnson is there. Look, Ontario Wilson, like guys who I'm not even sure Zach Collaros knows exist at this point, are not only getting the ball thrown to them, but they're catching it and making plays. One of the most electric plays of the week, I thought, was Ontario Wilson in overtime, catching a pass at the sidelines. Looked like he was going to be knocked out for like a pretty modest gain. And yet in a phone booth, he made a couple of defenders miss and got down for 19 yards down the sideline to set up what would have been a short field goal had Winnipeg not turned the ball over. Point is, I'm bullish on what Chris Trevler can do in this offense. No, I don't think that he's an elite downfield passer, but I think he brings an interesting dimension, and I'm encouraged by the way he was able to distribute the football, something that Zach Collaros has been completely unable to do through 4 games this season. So I will take the Bombers. The Montreal Alouettes are massive home favorites. Massive, JC! Over the Calgary Stampeders on Saturday evening at Percival Molson Stadium, currently sitting at 9.5 points, almost double digits. The Owls are off to a 4-0 start, having just beaten down the Toronto Argonauts, while the Stamps needed overtime to knock off the winless Blue Bombers. JC, you've been burned taking the points a few times this season. Can Montreal cover this widespread?
Well, we were delayed a little bit taping the podcast today, so I didn't have a chance to have breakfast or even have lunch, so I'm hungry. I'm hungry right now. My tummy, it's growling, and I want to eat all these points because the Montreal Alouettes have been by far the best team in the CFL right now. Their defense is dominant, and their offense has been a very, very pleasant surprise with the development of guys like Tyson Philpott in year 3 becoming legitimate top receivers in this league. Obviously, Calgary has Jalen, the twin brother, on the other side, who hasn't quite crested that hill yet. But I just don't see the Stampeders being able to keep up with the Alouettes' firepower. They're a solid team. They're a run-of-the-mill team. They're an average team. The Montreal Alouettes are a spectacular team, and I'm taking them to cover the 9.5-point spread.
Yeah, I didn't take Montreal to cover last week because I don't see them as a big explosive team. I see them as a dominant defensive team that plays really well on specials and is opportune on offense. Now, a couple of those opportune moments resulted in big points for that team last week. The Cole Speaker touchdown, the trick play on 3rd and short from Caleb Evans was sensational. I unfortunately am going to repeat that here. I am going to take the Calgary Stampeders to cover, but the Alouettes to win. I have already had lunch, JC. I'm a couple hours east of you, so I am not hungry as of the recording of this show. I am going to take the Montreal Alouettes to win, but I do think the Calgary Stampeders can cover. Even if it's in garbage time, even if it's Jake Mayer adding a touchdown late in this game while the Montreal Alouettes are playing off, I think that the Stamps can keep it close. I like how the Stamps are committed to the run. I like Calgary's defense. I thought they did a great job of shutting down Brady Oliveira. Not that the Alouettes look to run the ball a whole heck of a lot, but I think that the Stampeders are built to play close physical football, and so I think that they can go into Percival Molson and keep this one close, even if they're not necessarily going to win. The BC Lions are 5.5-point road favorites when they visit the winless Tiger Cats on Sunday at Tim Hortons Field. The Leos have won 3 straight games and will be well-rested for this one, while the Tabbies lost on a last-second field goal in Ottawa last week. JC, can BC extend their winning streak and cover this widespread?
We all know that Tim Hortons Field is a difficult place to play because of that fan base, but BC has that 10 days of rest that they're coming off of, and I think that's going to be critical because this is a team that is by far the best in terms of producing yards on offense right now. They've got the best quarterback in the league right now in Vernon Adams Jr. They've got weapons all over the board offensively, but it hasn't necessarily translated to points, right? They're middle of the pack in terms of scoring, and they've struggled to get majors in the red zone. Well, they come up against a Ticats team here that has allowed the most points of anyone in the CFL thus far this season. It could not come at a better time for the BC Lions, coming off a long break where they can tweak that offense and get them scoring again. I think they are going to have a little bit of an explosion here on the road and cover the 5.5-point spread.
I am with you, JC. I just said that the Montreal Alouettes are not a team built to blow out opponents. The BC Lions are, right? They love to throw the ball. Vernon Adams Jr. has played at an exceptionally high level so far this season. I think that this team is, you know, especially with the Ticats being battered, being bruised, I think that BC coming off, again, a very long week with lots of rest, is in great position to go in and take advantage of a Hamilton Tiger Cats defense that has struggled. I'm excited for Tim White, right, that he got going this past week in a loss to the Ottawa Red Blacks. The Ticats will need Tim White to be at the top of his game to get their first win of the season, if, dare say, they do manage to knock off the BC Lions here. But I like Vancouver's chances here of going into Sealtown and getting a win, not only just in the standings, but I think getting a win by enough to cover this spread. I would be happy taking BC to win and cover up to a touchdown in this one. If you can win at Princess Auto Stadium, which the Lions recently did, you can certainly win at Tim Hortons Field. Give me the Lions and the points. Now time for Hodges' Heritage Moment. On this day in 2021, Alex Mateus announced his retirement from the CFL at the age of 30. The Ottawa native was the first overall pick in the 2015 CFL draft out of the University of Connecticut and spent 2 years in a depth role with his hometown Red Blacks before becoming a two-time East Division All-Star at center, winning a Grey Cup in 2016. According to his social media, he is the founder and CEO of Athlete IQ, a program designed for youth athletes, as well as a commercial real estate agent. JC, what do you remember of Alex Mateus's career?
Well, obviously a top pick that lived up to the billing, becoming an all-star in that East Division. And I think his retirement at what is a reasonably young age for an offensive lineman at 30 years old really dealt a blow to the Red Blacks in an era when they just started to struggle after that pandemic. They've found Cyril Hogan-Sando to fill that void, but it was rough for a little bit after losing Alex Mateus because of just how strong he was in that center position.
Yes, and I mean, I know some people, even at the time, were a little bit critical because, yes, he needed some time to get acquitted to that starting role, but he was also playing behind John Gott, a guy who was playing at a all-star level for the Red Blacks after being acquired from the Calgary Stampeders via trade. Gott, I think, was a CFL all-star in 2015 and 2016, obviously helping that club win its first Grey Cup, if you don't count the Rough Rider years, of course, at center in 2016. I think, you know, Mateus would be great if he was still playing, right? He's still only in his early 30s. That being said, I'll never knock a guy for walking away when he feels it's the right time to do that. So best wishes to Alex Mateus. We've updated what you're apparently involved with these days. Hopefully you and your family are doing well. It's now time for the 3-minute drill. JC, the Toronto Argonauts have enshrined Bob Obilovich, Lou Heyman, and Peter Martin as all-time Argos. Was that overdue?
Absolutely it was overdue. My question is, what were the Argos doing before? Because this is supposed to be the most storied franchise in all of North American sports with its age and 18 Grey Cup championships. And you hadn't honored a guy who was winning them in the 1950s before? Like, what, your two winningest coaches of all time and Heyman and Bob Obilovich hadn't been honored before this week? That's absolutely ridiculous. Come on, Argos. We got to pick up our game here when it comes to honoring the history of a great franchise. The Hamilton Tiger Cats nabbed Canadian defensive lineman Deontay Knight off the practice roster from Toronto. Was that a good move?
It's a very good move. Anytime you can snake a former 10th overall pick for free then you're good to go. And no, it's not common for CFL teams to poach practice roster players off of one another. Yes, they are allowed to do so. Though I do believe that there is a mechanism for the Toronto Argonauts to have kept Deontay Knight if they wanted. They just would have had to keep him on the active roster. Evidently, they were unwilling to do so. Hamilton picks up a nice player for free, and they get it from their biggest rival. That's got to make you feel good as a Steeltown fan. Team Canada won gold at the IFAF U20 World Junior Championships in Edmonton. JC, how proud were you of our boys?
I was extremely proud. This, is, of course, was Canada's third consecutive gold medal at this tournament. They won in 2018 before the pandemic caused a whole bunch of delays, as well as in 2016. They are the predominant power in international football, and deservedly so. But my big takeaway from this tournament, and the thing that put the biggest smile on my face, Hodge, the United States in the World Championships of American football finishing fourth off the podium, getting their butts kicked by both Japan in the semis and Team Austria in the bronze medal game. You are no longer on top of the world.
Well, did you see that Robert Griffin III tweeted highlights of that game from Commonwealth when the U.S. lost to Austria in the bronze medal? I was reading the replies. So many Americans were so upset. It was wild.
I will never, never frown when the Americans are losing. The Ottawa Redblacks released former NFL running back Kylan Hill from their practice roster. Why do you think that is, Hodge?
Well, I would imagine it's because Reichwell Armstead has acquitted himself very nicely in that starting role, vacated, of course, by the injured Devontae Williams. The one thing I'll say about Armstead, he's got to hold on to the ball. Like, this guy is a running back, and he does not often, I noticed this past week especially, have it tucked up under his arm. He is often holding it with a single hand way out in front of him. That's going to cost him if he doesn't keep that ball under wraps. But kudos to him for taking that job. I thought he looked good this past week against Hamilton. The Tiger Cats fired special teams coordinator Paul Boudreau after only four games and replaced him with Dennis McKnight, who was with the team from 2017 to 2019. Was that move warranted, JC?
We've touched on this a little bit already. As you laid out the numbers, Hodge, they're not overwhelming against Paul Boudreau in terms of what this team has been able to produce, but they're not great either. And I think after a big mistake like that squib kick, a team that's struggling, a team that's trying to set a new culture, wants to send the message. And this was an easy message for the Ticats to send, that the performance is not good enough. And if you make mistakes like that, you're going to be out of here. That's a message to the players, and that's a message to the rest of the coaching staff as well. The Saskatchewan Roughriders signed QB Eric Berrier, who struggled for Winnipeg during the preseason. Hodge, do you still think he could be a good CFL quarterback?
Berrier was absolutely horrendous during the preseason, and when I was at training camp this year, he struggled. That being said, a guy with his collegiate accolades played at the same program as a number of very successful CFL quarterbacks, guys like Bo Levi Mitchell, guys like Matt Nichols, guys like Vernon Adams Jr. I think you have to give him another shot. It was an extremely small sample size. I'm glad that he's getting this next opportunity. You just hope that he makes better use of this opportunity in Sask than he did of his opportunity in Winnipeg, because he seems to have all the tools, right, to be a perfect CFL quarterback. And as said off the top of the show, we need more young quarterbacks stepping up and doing great things in this league. Last one, the Edmonton Elks selected North Dakota receiver Zach Mathis in the CFL's recent supplemental draft, forfeiting a first-round pick in 2025 to do so. Was that a smart move?
Look, there's two elements here, and I think Zach Mathis is a nice depth piece to add, right? He's not an overwhelmingly dominant statistical receiver, had about just over 600 yards last year for North Dakota State University, one of the prevailing powers at the FCS level, but he's got great length at 6'7". He's a guy I had pegged sort of a third round grade on, could potentially get inflated in these supplemental draft situations where there's only one prospect available. But for Edmonton, that first round pick seems awfully, awfully rich, particularly given that they had the top of the waiver order. That's equivalent to giving up the first overall pick. Maybe they'll be higher than that come next year because this team could improve. But this is a first round next year, bear in mind, that could contain Canadian quarterback Curtis Rourke. We don't know what his NFL interest level is going to be until he's played a full season at the University of Indiana. If he's available, you want to hang on to those first round picks. I don't care what franchise you are. There's a potentially generational quarterback prospect available in this draft. I'm not sure I'm giving up a first rounder for a depth receiver that might be able to help me right now.
I get that, but Edmonton already has a Canadian quarterback they don't play. So having a second one might not
I would
be valid.
Take Curtis Rourke over Trey Forgue in a heartbeat. And I don't think it's fair, all the criticism of, well, Chris Jones doesn't play Canadian quarterbacks. Chris Jones has played more Canadian quarterbacks than anybody else. Is he consistent? Is he good at managing his players? No, I don't think he makes those decisions correctly. But Trey Forgue is not a polished pocket passer like Curtis Rourke is. He's not a guy who... Curtis could be better than Nathan. There is a legit possibility. He's certainly more further ahead right now than Nathan was at any point in his college career. That means he could do big things as a pro. Now, the NFL could come calling. He could get a UFA offer. He could become a draft pick, and this all becomes moot because nobody's spending a first-round pick on him. But even if he's a low-level UDFA, the value of potentially adding him, potentially adding a Rourke-level quarterback, to me, that's worth first-round value. That might be even worth first overall pick value just based on taking the bet that you can get that type of quarterback.
I will just say this, and no, it's silly to say that, oh, well, Chris Jones doesn't play Canadian quarterbacks, because nobody plays Canadian quarterbacks. The criticism that he maybe should be using Trey Forgue, I think, is extremely warranted. And that's despite the fact that McLeod Bethel-Thompson is playing very well. He really is. I thought he played very nice, especially this past week. Looked really good. I think they need to be using Trey Forgue in certain packages. The other thing I will point out that somebody pointed out to me this past week is since becoming the head coach and GM of the Edmonton Elks in 2022, Chris Jones has won 8 games, and 5 of them were started by Trey Forgue. And that includes the 4 this week, this year so far, where they have lost with McLeod Bethel-Thompson. Now, they did lose Trey Forgue's last 4 starts last season, so that 8-game losing streak they're on is half Forgue, half McLeod Bethel-Thompson. But to me, the best thing to do is do the best of both worlds. Play McLeod Bethel-Thompson for, we'll call it, 80% of the snaps, and then have really creative packages to get Trey Forgue on the field for those other 20. Hell, you could get Trey Forgue on the field with McLeod Bethel-Thompson. You're allowed to have 2 quarterbacks on the field. Trey Forgue is arguably the best athlete on the Edmonton Elks, period. Athlete. Use him. You're 0-4. Use your best athlete. That doesn't seem like rocket science to me, but who knows? I'm not a real coach. I just play one on television. We thank you. Well, I play him on the internet, I guess. Not television, but whatever. We thank you, as always, for joining us on the 3 Down Nation podcast. We'll see you next week for another episode.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app.
Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor Super Drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.